Friday, July 19th. Today, delegates to the Democratic National Convention in Chicago are going home. Early this morning, President Roosevelt spoke by radio from the White House to accept a third-term nomination. His vice presidential running mate is to be Secretary of Agriculture Wallace. And in Europe, the bombing raids continue. New British raids on German bases and in the Mediterranean. New German raids on the British Isles. An Italian bombing attack on Gibraltar. But now the news from important capitals direct. First London, then Berlin. Afterwards, a report from our own national capital. First, a report of Edward R. Murrow from the British capital. Go ahead, London.
This is London. A number of people were casualties last night when a low-flying German plane bombed a tenement house in Scotland. Air raid wardens are still digging in the ruins to free possible survivors. Warships escorting a convoy off the Scottish coast fought off Nazi planes within sight of land last night. And this morning, an enemy raider flew out of the rising sun, loosed two salvos of bombs near a southeastern town, and started a fire. The number of casualties is not known. Although the German raids on this island continue to be relatively inconsequential, a small gun-spotting plane was sent over last night on a special photographing job. This low-speed German army plane was badly damaged by Britain's fast interceptors. Britain's Minister of Labor gave notice last night that he is empowered to conscript doctors for hospitals and other public services. It is hoped that essential medical posts will be filled on a voluntary basis at first, with the compulsory power held in reserve. The Ministry of Shipping says that French merchant ships in British ports will be taken over. They'll fly two flags, the Union Jack above the French tricolor. The announcement states that compensation will be paid for the use of the ships, and they'll be returned to France at the end of the war. The fifth large army casualty list was published this morning. Some 5,000 names of the dead, wounded, and missing have been listed so far this week. Mr. Churchill's statement yesterday on the closing of the Burma Road has had a mixed reception. The London Times says it is now for the Japanese to prove their sincerity by improving their relations with this country. The Times also hopes that this temporary arrangement may lead to a pacification in the Far East on the basis of the preservation of the independence and integrity of China. The Times does not explain how the independence and integrity of China is to be promoted by cutting off her principal source of supply of arms from the outside world. One argument presented to the Chinese by the British in defense of their decision was that it would help to maintain in power a relatively moderate Japanese government. That government has already fallen, and the new foreign minister, Mr. Matsuoka, has not sounded particularly moderate in his pronouncements to date. There are one or two Far Eastern experts in London prepared to bet that Japan will be making fresh demands against Shanghai and Hong Kong within the next 4 weeks. The Daily Telegraph hopes that with the expiration of the 3 months period, the United States will feel in a position to adopt a more decisive attitude toward the situation in the Far East. One English friend of mine, with a knowledge of American history, explained Britain's action in this way. He said, when the Mexicans were outside the Alamo, the garrison couldn't do very much about what was happening in Washington or New England. President Roosevelt's acceptance speech last night had a more pleasant sound to British ears than the Democratic Party platform. The Evening Standard calls him the new Lincoln, and the Evening News headlines its story, Roosevelt stands by aid to Britain. There is general satisfaction over here that both Roosevelt and Wilkie favor continued and increased aid to Britain. But most Britishers would be glad to have that election held next week rather than in November. The Ministry of Food last night held out a very definite hope of increased rations of tea, sugar, and perhaps cooking fats during the winter months. That hope, of course, is contingent on the defeat of German attacks during the next few weeks or months. Britain's Sealed Lips campaign is being promoted by the press, radio, and the courts. A young man in a Birmingham cafe thought it would be a good job when the British Empire is finished. He said, we are fighting to provide dividends for the ruling class. The judge said, 12 months in prison. A merchant seaman, charged with disobeying the demands of his skipper, was sentenced to 30 days. He gave the judge a Nazi salute and said, thank you, sir. Heil Hitler. The judge doubled his sentence. I return you now to CBS in New York.
That was Edward R. Murrow reporting from London. Here's the latest news from the Far East. Japan is demanding official disciplinary action in the alleged assault on two Japanese citizens by American Marines. The Japanese government has lodged a vigorous protest, and reserve the right to claim damages. It urges that steps be taken to prevent any more such incidents on grounds that they disrupt good Japanese-American understanding. Here's the latest news from the Balkans. Bucharest reports further effects of German and Italian influence in southeastern Europe, especially in Romania. The Bucharest government has decreed that Jews may not become Christians, and Jews no longer are to receive the customary annual government grant of money. Protestants, too, are reported in a precarious position. Now the news from the German capital, reported by Edwin Hartridge. Go ahead, Berlin.
This is Berlin. With the return of the troops to Berlin yesterday and the Gala Victory Parade, the last of the official celebrations over the defeat of France seemed to be finished. And now there's a place in every German calendar for the date of the beginning of the war against England. But only Herr Hitler knows this date. There's the general belief here among correspondents that Blitzkrieg will be given a formal send-off. That is, Herr Hitler may make a special speech to the Reichstag, or a radio address to the whole German nation. This, in turn, might also include some form of ultimatum, in essence, telling Winston Churchill and his people to surrender before it's too late. Anyway, those are some of the high points of the speculative conversations now taking place here. There is something in the air. Berlin is filled with important party, governmental, and military people. More than that, we cannot say at this moment. In the paper this morning, there's some very interesting photographs we found. They show the return of the German soldiers in December 1918 from the Western Front. And then the troops of the Third Reich parading victoriously down into London yesterday. What is interesting is the fact that on December 10th, 1918, parade of the war-weary and defeated soldiers down the same street provoked great enthusiasm among the Berliners. They were received as if they had returned victorious. Streets and buildings were decorated, as they were yesterday, with garlands of flowers. Speakers were made on behalf of the people of Berlin to welcome back their menfolk from 4 years of war on the Western Front. And the press this morning also continues to criticize the French papers as not understanding what the relation should be between a victorious country and a defeated one. For instance, yesterday, the Temps of Paris, now published in Clermont-Ferrand, claimed that the Germans have separated the occupied and unoccupied portions of France by, quote, a Chinese wall, unquote. This criticism drew a return fire from the German press. And the papers here accused the French press of giving too much prominence to British news and commentaries of the Reuters agency. Then this morning, the publisher Bierbacher claims that a French radio station in Tunis is broadcasting, quote, English lies, unquote, in the form of news reports. The Berlin papers go on to state that a protest must be filed against this attitude and this tendency. And they look to the government of Vichy to, quote, change the situation before more damage can be done. Then, Colonel Benaroc, who founded the French Fascist Party, the Croix de Feu, on the course of fire some years ago, has cropped up in the news again. The colonel is exciting the anger of the Germans by his statements that he will not dissolve his party, mainly consisting of World War veterans. On the contrary, he intends to expand it. But the colonel adds in a plaintive note that unfortunately he is not able to publish his paper in the German-occupied territory. Then, according to dispatches from Vichy, the Pétain government is reported to be greatly angered by the British seizure of 260,000 tons of foodstuffs in their new blockade. The Vichy government has pointed out that there is a great need in France at this time for food supplies. Incidentally, the first shipments of Red Cross food supplies from America have arrived both in the occupied and unoccupied portions of France. I was told by the local representative in Berlin. Then there is some news from another occupied country. According to the Deutsche Zeitung, the German newspaper for Holland, some incidents have taken place in some of the towns of the Netherlands. And these incidents were contrary to the measures taken from such, as they describe it, wild incidents, which under no circumstances will be allowed in the future. This is Edwin Hartridge, a returning now to Columbia in New York.
And such is the news from overseas. Now the latest reports from our own national capital, where only a few hours ago, early this morning, President Roosevelt addressed the Democratic National Convention by radio to accept the third term nomination. For the report of John Charles Daly, we take you now to Washington.
This is Washington. It was shortly before midnight Washington time, or 1 o'clock Eastern Daylight Time. The president had been scheduled to speak at 9 o'clock. 20 tired camera, newsreel, and radio men who had been in the Oval Room of the Little White House, or rather the Oval Room of the Big White House, since a little after 8 o'clock, had practically given up all hope that the president would accept or reject by radio a third term on this July 18th of 1940. Presumably, most of the population of the United States, they argued, certainly would be in bed. The wrangling went on at the Democratic Convention in Chicago, and the votes of state delegation after state delegation were polled. Some of the camera and radio men in the Oval Room were yawning. Others were frankly asleep, still others red-eyed but determined, read magazines they'd wisely brought along. All of them had put in a similar vigil at the White House the previous night, and it had been expected the president might say something then in relation to his nomination for a third term for the presidency. He hadn't, as you know. But the correspondents, the newsreel and radio men, didn't know he wouldn't until well after 2 a.m. They had gotten very little sleep that night, and as a result, most of them were dog-tired. It was then, just a minute or two before midnight Washington time, that Presidential Secretary Steve Early sauntered in. They roused from their respective lethargies and gathered around him, expecting his announcement that in view of the lateness of the hour, the president had decided to call off his radio address to the delegates at the Chicago Convention and to the nation until the following day. Mr. Early was to the point. If Wallace is nominated on the first ballot, he said, the president is going to make his radio talk, even if it is awfully late. But if Secretary Wallace fails to get the nomination on the first ballot, the president will do it tomorrow. After all, he went on looking around him and smiling wryly, the president, too, was tired. He, too, had been up until after 3 the previous morning and had risen only a few hours later. He was going to bed if the first ballot failed to be conclusive. The sleepy scene of a few minutes previous in the Oval Room was changed to a comparative bedlam. The radio men started to ready their equipment and check their lines. They grabbed telephones to let their headquarters in New York and Chicago know what might be coming. The cameramen started getting their cameras focused again. A portable radio of one of the radio engineers continued to blare the slow-moving results of the balloting out in Chicago. And then it happened. Another 10 minutes, Secretary of Agriculture Henry A. Wallace received a majority of votes, and the men of the Oval Room really got busy. 2 minutes later, a Secret Service man at the door called out, "The President," and in came Mr. Roosevelt, smiling, surrounded by a small group of intimate friends. He came over to the desk at one end of the room, peeled off his coat, smiled as the still cameraman took picture after picture. The radio men had things all set by then. Senator Barkley made the speech of presentation out in Chicago. His voice came to the president over a little portable radio set. At the conclusion of Barkley's remarks, the president started to speak. His voice was controlled but expressive as he continued through approximately 3,500 words. Most of us felt that we had never heard the president speak so well. As the president talked, a summer insect attracted by the single light on the president's desk began to flutter in and out of the shade of the lamp in ever-increasing glides that finally ended in a series of miniature power dives. The insect would slap against the page of the president's script as he read, zoom up within a fraction of his head, and then float slowly across the president's line of vision into the lampshade. I, for one, thought of taking action. Secretary Early rose and then sank back into his seat. It was too risky a business to hunt our interloper down when the president was talking. A minute later, the crisis was over. Mr. Roosevelt wiped his brow, and as he talked with a large linen handkerchief, he dropped it on the desk. Our unwelcome visitor had just dropped to the desk to start a new attack, and the presidential handkerchief dropped right on top of him. Those of us near the president's desk subsided, felt that that was a smile curling on the corner of the president's mouth as he glanced up quickly and then continued with his address. When in 1936 I was chosen by the voters for a second time as president, remarked, it was my firm intention to turn over the responsibilities of government to other hands at the end of my term. But he continued, the grave international events threatening ultimate destruction of all we have held dear had led him to cast aside this idea. My conscience will not let me turn my back upon a call to service, he declared, maintaining that only the people themselves can draft a president. And he added, if such a draft should be made upon me, I say in the utmost simplicity, I will, with God's help, continue to serve with the best of my ability and the fullness of my strength. There was the answer to the third term question. We return you now to New York.
And with this news from Washington, we conclude this morning report of national and international developments. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.